Okay, everyone, we're going to get started. So as many of you know, my name is Maria. I'm one of the co-directors of the Center for the Study of Women and Gender. Come in, yeah, please come in. Or you might need, yeah, Karis, and you're happy to. So, and maybe prop the door open, Karis, for now, with the bin. Thank you. Yes, so as I was saying, I'm Maria. I'm one of the co-directors of the Center for the Study of Women and Gender. And we're really, really delighted to have with us today, all the way from Australia, recently landed in Europe, still a bit jet-lagged, not quite. Who knows?
You've got a small baby as well,
yeah. So who knows whether it's jet lag or baby sleep deprivation. This is Dr. Akane Kanai, who many of us in the centre are massive fans of, and so we're delighted and honoured to have you with us here today. And Akane is going to share some work with us today, and specifically the title of the paper is Disavowals and Distinctions, Knowing Feminist Subjects in Social Media Culture. So thank you so much for joining us. The plan is that we'll listen to Akane for, do you have a sense of?
Probably a 40, maybe, yeah. 40 minutes, maybe less.
Yeah, and then yeah. We'll have some time after that for questions and answers and discussion. I know some of you have seminars to attend, seminars to teach even in some cases. So if you need to leave early, just feel free to get up and go. We won't think that you're leaving in protest of Akane's presentation. So, thank you so much.
Great.
Wonderful to have you.
Right. Well, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, as Maria mentioned, I have a small baby and I've just come back from leave a couple of weeks ago. So please forgive me if this is a bit all over the place and a bit jumpy. It draws a little bit on an article that came out during my maternity leave, but I'm trying to draw together a number of threads, so it'd be really good to hear, yeah, I guess, if it makes sense to you and how it maybe connects with the work you're doing or what you're interested in as well. But before I get into it, I just want to acknowledge that the work was conducted on the unceded lands of different Aboriginal nations in Australia. Monash University, where I'm located, is located on the lands of Wurundjeri people. And it's, I guess, traditional to make this acknowledgement, but it can also feel quite weird because then you'll kind of acknowledge something genocidal, then you go on to your own paper. So I guess I just wanted to note that before, because I think I just want to open up a space where people can talk about some of these quite prickly dynamics in social justice cultures where, you know, people can, I guess, acknowledge some of the complexities of how we know and what we know tackle some of these questions in a kind of a small way, perhaps not in a capital D decolonial way, but, you know, just noting that. So this paper is from a larger project where I have been interviewing young feminists over the past few years. So it involved three rounds of data collection. There's been the first sort of online workshops where we discussed what young feminists were finding useful about feminist social media culture. And then following on from that, two follow-up interviews, one-on-one, because, you know, having sort of a group context is not always the most, conducive way for having sort of deep discussions. So that the data collection is done, so I'm just kind of making sense of what has come out of that at this point. I'm not going to a huge amount of detail about the methods themselves, but you can always ask me about them later. So today I'm discussing how feminist knowledge is operationalized via particular rules and practices and how they help to establish what feminism is and what feminism means, which I'm quite interested in given that feminism is such a dispersed, broad sort of canon, and yet there seem to be quite concentrated ideas of what certain things come to mean via social media culture. This paper focuses on how young feminists operationalize knowledge in particular ways and how that can be quite, and you can sort of draw a line from the sort of leadership capitals, I'm going to use that term broadly, and how knowledge is operationalized in their feminist journeys. So, and in this way, I seek to contribute to a broader literature where a lot has been done on how, you know, social media culture, great place for people to access knowledge, and it's really good for informing yourself, etc. But across this work, particularly on, I guess, social justice-based work, there isn't necessarily, there hasn't been a lot of interrogation of how knowledge itself can limit, how knowledge is very productive of the particular identities that could then be adopted. Knowledge is generally sort of constructed as something quite inert. So it's something you gain. You go to a space, you find the knowledge, and then you go use it, as opposed to something that really can shape and limit your positions and your perspectives and the perspectives from which young feminists proceed. So one thing that I want to really focus on is a key cultural contradiction that shapes how young feminists come to know what feminism is and operationalize feminism. And that is the imperative on young people, particularly young women or people that are, I guess, constructed as the representatives of gender diversity. But that's the imperative to be exceptional and to be leaders, but at the same time to know their place. And that contradiction is quite operative in what I've seen in my work so far. Okay, so I want to start introducing you through the talk to some of my participants. So the first one I'm calling Gabby, or all my participants here have pseudonyms, but I'm interviewing her on a winter's night in lockdown in 2021. Melbourne had, where I live, had an extremely full-on intensive lockdown in 2021 and in 2020. So we're talking on Zoom, and she's sitting in her bedroom, still lives with her parents' house, but it's kind of cozy and it's sort of fun. It's almost as though, it feels very social, I guess, in this kind of setup that we have. But so Gabby is a 21-year-old white woman, student in her final year of undergrad. She's fun and she's chatty, and there are sort of these, you know, these ripples of laughter and curiosity as she shares with me examples of her feminist social media content, which is what I have asked them to do in the interviews. So this one comes up from UN Women. So in this tweet, you can see that UN Women combines words such as, well, it says throw them out with the bins, and then there are all these things that are kind of wrong with the world. So unequal pay, you know, sexual harassment, sexist jokes, that kind of thing. And so the tweet in and of itself might seem somewhat generic, I guess, but what was really interesting about it was the way it revealed Gabby's concerns with two concepts that she used interchangeably, and that was girl boss and neoliberal feminism. So Gabby felt that this tweet demonstrated that UN Women, the body UN Women, was a bit girl boss, to be honest. And girl boss is not something that you want to be. According to Gabby, she said, I feel like, yeah, this is very like neoliberal white feminism from memory. Like a lot of what white feminism loves to focus on is like the gender pay gap, which is obviously a big issue. But then there are things like just how different women of color versus white women are treated when they go to the doctors and stuff like that. And so she went on to acknowledge that there's only so much you can put in 140 characters or in an infographic, but it could have been more nuanced with some of the issues only concerning a certain type of woman. So what was interesting to me was how, because the call was pretty broad, I guess, but how Gabby shared this tweet with me. I don't know if they're still called tweets now, actually, now that the name of the platform has changed, but in order to express her critique of it. And further, I was struck by the application of critique via these concepts, that of girl boss and that of neoliberal feminism, which appeared to delineate a certain kind of subjectivity, so, and a certain type of sort of hypothetical woman. So one that wasn't inclusive, one that was self-focused and had individual ambitions. But I was really struck by the sort of negative connotations attached to girl boss, given that so many of my participants were, in my view, naively girl boss material, to use girl boss as a loose term, and not how Gabby meant it. So that is, they were very driven. They were often very focused on self-development and particularly interested in social justice. They had participated in a number of different programs to become leaders, because institutionally what we see for youth, often in sort of, I guess, advanced industrial economies, is this real kind of conflation of youth, social justice and leadership together, as though they all have to be the same thing. So young people are told you have to be a leader, particularly if you care about social justice. So many of my participants, as I was saying, I thought were kind of girl boss material. And Gabby, in her own words, was the kind of person who tended to float into leadership positions. So she said, "I'm like very loud, and being at the forefront really comes naturally to me." When she was in high school, people would defer to her. And she said, "It seemed like every time I was in a group project, it felt almost like people would kind of look to me to kind of take charge and delegate and bring everyone together. I suppose that's just where it started." Being an older sibling too. So indeed, many of my participants have been marked as young leaders, particularly if they care about social justice. So another participant, Bella, exemplified this imperative to make the most of every opportunity. So throughout her life, from when she was in primary school, she had applied and been accepted into numerous youth leadership and ambassadorship programs, being a youth advocate for an international charity, which she had then parlayed into other speaking commitments for a streetwear brand, period underwear brand, seeking to align their mission with feminist values. So that was Bella. Working class Julie, by way of contrast, hadn't been seen as a leader from the beginning. She had been really bullied in school for being a big brown girl in a predominantly white context. But with the support of high school teachers, she had grown in confidence, and then at university had sought election in different collectives. So there were kind of all these different pathways, but this kind of emphasis on leadership was very much in the water for my young participants. But how participants brought to bear their analysis of feminism and what counted as feminist could be quite different, notwithstanding this general imperative to be a leader. So the question of who deserved to stand out as feminist and the analysis of their feminist credentials came to the fore. So in my previous work, the kinds of figures that came up are often very famous Hollywood women like Taylor Swift, the Kardashians, etc. But what I'm going to discuss today is actually a case of Australian feminist micro-celebrity. So those personalities seem to have feminism as a substantive part of their identity, whose feminism was felt to have broad appeal and whose content was to have more proximate application in the everyday for my participants. So I kind of talk about how this genre of feminist celebrity was actually much more operative for my participants than, I guess, the really big famous people, though they also came up at different moments. So the three people I'm going to be looking at today are Clementine Ford, Abby Chatfield, and Liliana Henkin. So has anyone heard of these people before? That's totally fine. I use the term micro-celebrity also because they're not extremely famous. But they're quite well known in the Australian feminist landscape. But what's quite interesting, I think, about these three cases is the way they bring forth different forms of evaluation from my participants based on their own kinds of capitals as well. So this is Clementine Ford. She, I guess, was really deemed the central reference point for feminism in Australia, I guess, in this study. But I think more broadly that makes sense. She's been writing for quite some time. She began writing for Victorian newspaper, The Age, Victoria being the state where Melbourne is, in the 2000s, and has become known over some decades for her vocal feminist perspectives, particularly to do with matters of sexual assault. So she continues to write and post about politics more broadly. So she speaks on, you know, abortion, sexual politics, Indigenous rights, refugee politics, and so on. So she's quite, I guess, politically prolific, I guess, in that way. And is also, you know, but in the way that she speaks has a really, I guess, a sense of being quite educated that comes forth with her as well. So she speaks very much as an authority on a number of matters. According to one of my participants, her whole brand is feminist. So regardless of how she was discussed, she was really a central reference point for my participants. But what was notable for me was how some, but not all participants, really looked up to her achievements and her achievements as a woman. So, for example, Ali, a 21-year-old white woman who was studying politics at university, was very favourably inclined towards Ford. She said, just a bit about Ali, though. Ali's background, she was the first in the family at university. She said she'd been afforded a very good childhood by her parents, one who was a blue-collar worker, the other who worked in customer service, and said, you know, there were no major family issues, you know, mental health issues or alcoholism or deaths or anything like that. But like many young people who didn't inherit significant educational cultural capital from their parents, Ali lacked a lot of confidence in her own knowledge in the university setting in particular. So, for example, while she really enjoyed the group workshop that I first ran, she said it was very interesting, she said she felt the others were much more educated and well-spoken. So Ali attributed significant authority to Ford. She endorsed her cultural capital. She noted she was older and had much more experience and other emerging influences. I'd say Ford's probably around 40 now. She said Ford was very educated, very well-spoken, and could speak to theories in how she described the world. And this was evidently something that Ali aspired to herself. Julie, who I mentioned before, is that also viewed Ford very much as a woman who had valuable stories to share. So she recommended Ford's memoir, Fight Like a Girl, to her mother, who was otherwise often intimidated by the sexism that she faced every day in the world. So Julie, for example, would go with her mum to the doctors and help advocate for her and do things like that. So Julie acknowledged that Ford was white and felt badly that, you know, she didn't follow more women of colour, but she viewed this more as her own failure to correct her own whitewash social media feed. So there was kind of acknowledgement of the racial element and of Ford being white and a feminist, but Julie kind of took it upon herself to say, well, that's who I'm following at the moment. But for other participants, Ford was viewed less as a woman with lived history, with views to impart, and more as a public text to analyse. So for these participants, it was impossible to unequivocally endorse Ford. So Hayley, a white 25-year-old master's student, casually surmised Ford's contributions this way. I think she does fantastic work, but she also makes a lot of money off of feminism, and she's been noted to plagiarise Indigenous authors. So it comes with the downsides of what feminism can be to me, which is the co-opting of a movement. It's the neoliberalism, it's the white feminism that I find problematic. So there's a lot to analyse here, and leaving aside the plagiarism claim, which I was not able to find any mention, any mention of, but that both white feminism and neoliberalism are kind of condensed in their meanings, and that neoliberalism comes to the fore again. The Ford's centrality to feminism, Australian feminism, and her high profile status that she was able to operationalise engendered uneasiness about her feminist credentials. In this vein, viewed as a public text, the recurring question turned on Ford was whether or not Ford was problematic. In one instance, her paid featuring of a cleaning brand in her social media feed mocked by participants. Ford wasn't likeable. Despite her attempts to be accessible to her audience through her podcast, Big Sister Hotline, and other events, Ford's status as a feminist authority and reference point was a double-edged sword. So the attributes bestowing her the confidence and eloquence that was admired by so many of my more aspiring middle-class participants were connected to her whiteness and middle-class cultural capital that were that could be deemed problematic by another group of my participants, the more established middle-class participants, but who were also often white. That was quite a long sentence, but, you know, I'm going to elaborate this as we go on. But for these participants, I guess, who had a significant inherited cultural capital, and often who were also white, the practice of acknowledging upfront the controversies surrounding public figures also worked to protect them from any perception they aligned themselves with these figures' potential problematic behaviour. So neoliberal white feminism being attached to successful figures such as Ford. But the label of neoliberal was not as sticky for everyone. So, for example, Abby Chatfield, another white middle-class feminist, but one considered to be significantly more likeable and relatable than Ford. I wonder if this will work. But you can kind of see.
So is there sound to it?
Oh, there's no sound. Okay. There's no sound. Yeah. That's just off my phone. But basically, so Abby Chatfield hosts a podcast, and she but shot to fame through reality TV. So she her first claim to fame was being on The Bachelor in Australia. And she was a highly vilified contestant. She was really harassed on social media. People basically got in their heads that she was, I don't know, incredibly stupid or, you know, something. And they really just went to town on her. So what Chatfield went on to do was to rebuild herself as a feminist commentator through her own social media profile, podcasts and sponsorships. She launched an inclusively sized clothing brand in mid-2022 and has done other collaborations with an Australian lingerie brand more recently. So Chatfield felt accessible, and while outspoken, she was someone who didn't hold herself out as an expert. So Ali explained, you know, she's not as educated as Clementine Ford, for example, and she's quite open about that. She doesn't pretend to be someone who's super academic and knows everything. You know, she doesn't get into gender theories or anything super in depth like that. But, you know, this was key to Chatfield's appeal for Ali. She just talks very casually and she's very outspoken, but I really like what she says. And she doesn't tear down other women, which is nice. And it's very casual, just like talking to a friend. Chatfield was thus relatable because while she had a degree in property economics and enjoyed professional success prior to her appearance on The Bachelor, her intellect didn't distance herself from listeners. Chatfield's warmth was appealing for many of my participants who needed reassurance, particularly participants who needed reassurance they were doing womanhood right. So while bringing the sexual capital of a face and body enabling paid work as an ambassador for a lingerie brand, Chatfield had never presented herself as a top girl due to her reality TV origins. She shared her everyday problems with listeners and didn't purport to give answers, instead using her podcast guests and listeners as sounding boards. So thus, while she was highly involved in commercial media, working as a judge on The Masked Singer, I don't know if you know that show, I think there's a US version, where there's a judge and they're in a costume and they take their costume off and that's, you know, Bobby from Queer Eye singing. Anyway, she's also hosted on F-Boy Island, which you saw a picture of, which is also a US show. But Chatfield has never been seen as a sellout. She's always seemed authentic, but stayed in her lane. And this kind of lack of sophistication was looked favourably upon by participants. But Kira, who was a 28-year-old aspiring police officer, was quite unique in her thoughtful critique of Chatfield's relative lack of knowledge and its racialised and class nature. So she said, it's not even so much a criticism as, you know, just a note. I mean, no one can be really perfect, especially in an online world. There's obviously a lot of privilege there as a white woman from a relatively middle-class background who's able-bodied. And a lot of the privileges she has are privileges I share as well, so I don't claim to, you know, be able to do a better job necessarily. Just noting there's a lot of caveats on what she said. But then Kira says, but I think just because of her standing in society, it means a lot of her opinions on things are not thoroughly considered when it comes to other disadvantages or minorities. So Kira highlighted how Chatfield's claims to not be an expert, lauded as being unpretentious, paradoxically licensed her to articulate her views on a public stage, while for Ford, her claims to expertise made her less likable and subject to critique. So I'm now going to turn to our last influencer. So this is Lillian Ahenkin, aka Flex Mummy is her pseudonym. So in a similar vein to Chatfield, I'm just going to call her Flex. So Flex Mummy was seen as straight-talking, confident, authentic. An entrepreneur who had spent time on the Australian version of Big Brother, MTV, and working as a DJ, Flex Mummy was not educated in the same way as Ford, or even as Chatfield, who had completed a bachelor's degree. But like Chatfield and Ford, she is regularly featured in the Australian media landscape. Her beautiful, pastel pop-coloured first home and holiday home have been featured in design magazines. She is currently the Australian ambassador of the dating app Bumble, which is marketed as for women and kind of has, you know, feminist undertones, though, you know, people say that it doesn't actually really stop any of the harassment, really. But in general, Flex was evaluated as authentic, unapologetic, and just saying what she thinks. What came up a lot was this sense of refusing to be everyone's teacher. So for Jess, who was 21, from the country, big Catholic family, she said that Flex was very honest and admired her for drawing her boundaries. She said she has heaps of followers, but she refuses to be everyone's teacher about all these concepts because it can be such a burden, especially on women of colour, to explain their lived experience to white women who don't get it as much. So I really like her for that. So this refusal to teach contrasted with Clementine Ford's sustained attempts at public education. So while Ford would organise Feminist Fridays where people could ask any questions she would attempt to answer, these attempts at accessibility weren't necessarily affectively appealing. Flex Mummy was seen as admirable in contrast by many participants for the way she positioned her knowledge and time as something to be protected and cordoned off. And in particular, Flex's position as a black woman of Ghanaian heritage legitimated this assertiveness, I think. Commonly voiced in the workshops was the understanding that women of colour should not be obligated to spend the extra emotional labour required to educate others. So for Flex, this assertiveness and refusal to waste time teaching was also intertwined with her brand as a successful and authentic entrepreneur. So Daisy, for example, who was the president of a university-based feminist collective, mentioned how they would use her reflex cards as a social activity. So what's reflex? Daisy said, she has this brand called Reflex and the critical thinking cards. So like, would you rather be admired or envied? That wasn't a good example, but yeah, questions like that. And so yeah, we play that and we have brunch. Daisy was a young aspiring leader. While she self-consciously noted that she couldn't go into diversity leadership employment positions because look at me, so Daisy was white, she was passionate about seizing any opportunities connected to her activism and showed a shrewd entrepreneurial disposition in connection with this. Flex's brand spoke to these aspirations. Though she purported to not educate people as such, Flex did give life advice about instilling confidence, managing time, drawing boundaries, all best-selling topics in self-help genres. Ella, who we met at the beginning of this paper, also spoke of the way Flex discussed managing her time in one of her previous podcasts. She said, if you think about your activism, you could think of it as like a pie chart. Like if you're going to give 5% of your time to every single cause, how much time are you really giving? So Flex then occupied quite a favorable position. Her blackness enhanced the legitimacy of her discussion of boundary drawing, self-investment, confidence, topics of keen interest to my white middle-class participants who were invested in leadership. Though interestingly, my participants of color did not particularly single out Flex Mummy in terms of people they admired. But overall, Flex, viewed as an online mentor, as public figure, was seen as someone who had made it and was passing on lessons about an emotional orientation to life, not from gender theory, but from experience. And for my ambitious participants, these attitude lessons authenticated the value of safeguarding their own time. So Ella took on board Flex's criticism of online activity that's sought to spread across many issues rather than channeling them into a few. But this thriftiness with her energy didn't sit right with absolutely everyone. So for another of my participants who was quite young, who had just moved to Melbourne, was from a large family with lots of boys. She was trying to connect new friends to feminism and was finding, you know, that she was the one of the main translators of feminism for her friends. And she said, look, she was kind of saying you don't owe your friends anything just because they're your friends. You don't owe them your time. You don't have to listen to them. I don't know. I guess that didn't really resonate with me because I feel like if someone is a really close friend, I would do a lot for them. But that's definitely a message she tries to put out. So I've covered, you know, quite a lot of ground, but what I'm trying to make of this is that the feminist micro-celebrities I've discussed, Ford, Chatfield, and Ahenkin, occupied classed, gendered, and racialized positions, embodying some of the contradictions, imperatives, and desires presented for my participants themselves. So Ford's contested status signaled that in these online feminist knowledge cultures, being able to keep up to date with the controversies around individual public feminists was just as important as reading the text that they produced. For both Chatfield and Flex Mummy, their ability to refuse the position of feminist educator or expert paradoxically protected their entrepreneurial activities from questions of integrity or authenticity. While Ford was sometimes decried for her problematic views, Flex Mummy legitimated a confidence in self-promotion that authenticated the desires of high-achieving white participants like Ella and Daisy, who otherwise would eschew explicitly neoliberal feminism. So the openly individualistic and entrepreneurial ethos of Flex, and to some extent Chatfield, was able to pass under their radar because of their capacities to present their feminist ethos as tightly tied and not surpassing their own authentic experience. So these tensions demonstrated some of the stakes of how identity becomes entangled in claims to knowledge. in a fast-paced, seemingly accessible, but also unequal social media economy. To straightforwardly like a feminist, even while being a feminist, could be risky. Misplaced investments could just demonstrate a lack of expertise, something that was very important for participants themselves, even if it was not for the people they were talking about. And it could reveal the problematic nature of your feminism. You could get it wrong in the apparent abundance of information that social media created. So while these online knowledge cultures enabled the accessibility of feminist ideas, their take-up and significance also demonstrated how feminist legitimacy was a finite resource, particularly for women who sought to be public feminist commentators in the online sphere, and for young women as well, in negotiating the lines between standing out in being feminist leaders and knowing your place. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you for sitting through quite a long talk. Thank you. And please feel free to, ask any questions, any comments.
I'll stop the recording so that people don't have to worry about being recorded in